Would putting ourselves on level with a computer, efficient, precise, and speedy, also make us lose creativity or make us boring and predictable? The brain's supposed weaknesses and imperfections are what make the brain and us adaptable, dynamic, and creative. Henning Beck is a neuroscientist who has looked into this and many other aspects of the brain. He titled his book Scatterbrain: How the Mind's Mistakes Make Humans Creative, Innovative, and Successful. The title alone already has me feeling more comfortable in my own skin. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Henning, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Pleasure.
Do you think there are common misconceptions about the brain, and is there one that you feel needs clarifying more than another?
One particular flaw we have, or cognitive misconception we have, is that the memory we have, or that we remember the past, has to be perfect, that our memory is not perfect. And everybody thinks that the sense, or the purpose, to say, of our memory is that we remember what happened in our past perfectly, but the purpose of our memory is that we plan the future. And once you understand that the memory is not to remember stuff, but to plan the future, it totally changes the view on your brain.
Well, let's move into the memory a little bit right now, since that's where you got us started. What stands out about what you have learned about remembering then?
Many people think that the brain is like a flash drive, and it calculates, or it collects all the incoming sensory input and the events you perceive and things you experience throughout your life, and then it stores all these events in the brain wherever it is. But this is not the case. The brain constantly creates memories. It creates thoughts. A thought is not located anywhere in the brain. A memory is not located anywhere in the brain. It is how the brain is able to create a specific pattern, a specific activity state. So it's always like you create the memory in the very moment, just like an orchestra. If you look at an orchestra from outside, you don't have no idea what this orchestra is able to play. And the melody is always created in the very moment. Music is not stored in an orchestra, but the orchestra has the ability to create something. Same with the brain. Memories, thoughts, ideas, emotions, not located anywhere, but this is the ability of the brain to create something.
Now, is there a tipping point that will store some kind of information, if not a memory, into a part of the brain that will help keep it from changing or keep it more consciously available?
Well, of course, the brain is very, very lazy, and it tries to make things simple. So what we do constantly do, we have emotions, we have perceptions that basically are like a mental shortcut to encode specific information more vividly than others. So you remember certain events from your past despite the fact that you only experienced them once, and you don't have to repeat some stuff over and over, but you see it, you feel it, you do it, you connect with others, and these things keep memories active and keep things very prominent in your brain.
Now, you say it's more technically difficult to recognize a song than compute 35 times 27. And it appears to be the opposite, as we all drive down the road singing words to songs that we learned 30 years ago.
Yes. The brain, interestingly, the brain does not think in numbers, in letters, in words. The brain thinks in concepts. You imagine when you have something on your mind, very often you have an impression, you have a picture, you have a pattern, you have a feeling, you have abstract things on your mind. And this is the language of your brain. And of course we can calculate stuff, of course we can focus on certain data or information, but the basic language of your brain is patterns, emotions, pictures, feelings, and this is way more important in our daily life than to calculate things properly.
Now, the way you bring up emotions with the brain, they're interacting. What does the brain actually have to do with emotions?
Basically, a shortcut or a boost to learn things faster. When you have emotions, for instance, you fear something, or you feel disgust or pain. This is always it's a very primitive way of calculating information, of dealing with information, and it's very fast. You don't have to think how to react when you feel disgust or pain or fear or joy. So it's always the same cross-culturally. So wherever you are in the world, the feeling of joy is always the same. And it basically speeds up your mental processing. And the higher cognitive things, like when you imagine stuff, when you plan things, when you do hypotheses, when you remember things, this is basically built on top of all these emotions. There's no decision in our world that is completely rational. It's always driven by emotions, basically. And emotions basically speed up the way how you process information.
What slows down the process in the brain?
Well, too many information. So if you have too many things to organize or to orchestrate, this is what you know from your daily life, that you have your smartphone constantly ringing or emails coming in or text messages or news that are always going into your attention, and then it is difficult to multitask and to say what is important, what is not important. So keep in mind that just as you have to digest nutrition and food, your brain has to digest information. When you're constantly eating, you're exploding eventually. Same with the brain. When you're constantly consuming information, the brain is like exploding, which feels like that the time is rushing, that you don't prioritize, that you feel under pressure, that you cannot concentrate, that you lose focus, get distracted. And this is always the case because you did not digest information. And this basically slows down your cognitive processes.
So, Henning, obviously taking a break is a good thing to do in order to continue digesting more and more information. But is there anything else that you recommend? The way emotions seem to drive things, as you say, it would probably be great to just do something totally joyful in a break for even a minute, and maybe that would help things. Is that true, or what do you have to say?
Well, two things. First, connect with other people. Ask other people. This is important because you change your perspective, you challenge your point of view, you do something with other people, and this is usually very interesting, and it spices up your own perspectives. And this is always the case that you ask somebody, or it's always helping to ask somebody who is not an expert in a field, who is giving you a fresh view from outside, and usually challenges what you thought before. And there's a great quote by Abraham Lincoln who said, I don't like this man. I have to get to know him better. And this is this curiosity, this connecting with others is super important in order to organize information in a better way, to get better decisions, to get better ideas, and to get a better memory. And additionally, everybody is calling for positive emotions, for happiness and joy and something like that. Interestingly, being unhappy from time to time is not a bad thing. Consider if we are happy all the time, then there is no need for progress. Why should there be a need for a good idea, for a new invention when you are happy? Happy people don't change the world. Unhappy people, dissatisfied people change the world because they have a problem they want to dig in and want to find a problem, want to find a solution. And so from time to time, cultivate unhappiness, be dissatisfied in an optimistic way, so to say. This is a good approach to get a good ideas.
Yes, and it also is the impetus of great songwriting as well, isn't it?
Yeah, great songs. Many songs are super sad, right? People are working with bad emotions and try to cope with bad events. And same with inventions, same with entrepreneurs, same with artists, scientists. All the people that have problems, but they don't give in. They try to ask questions. They try to challenge themselves. They try to ask other people. They go for it. Those are the ones who change the world, right?
Yes, and Boy, I just love that quote because, of course, it would do humanity better, right, on that one-on-one personal level. But also, it does definitely start the creative juices moving for any problem or any situation that you're in. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that. That's great. Henning, what do you think about the comparison of the brain to a computer? Does it drive you crazy, or are there certain things you want to bring out about that?
Yes, it is driving me crazy because it's totally wrong. Yeah. Everything you hear about analogies about the brain and the computer basically are nonsense, because all what we know from the brain is that it is totally different from any kind of computer system. Of course, the brain deals with information. Of course, the brain tries to organize information, tries to learn from it, of course, but it does it totally different than a computer does it. As I said, consider the brain more like an orchestra that is always creating new patterns, new melodies, new synchronizations, and these synchronizations among the musicians or the neurons, so to say, the nerve cells, they are basically the thought, whereas computer systems always work with this input processing output principle. So you give an input, they process this input, and they give an output. And this is not the case in the brain, because processing, playing the music is the music, and having a thought is creating the thought. So it's one and the same. So everything you hear about artificial intelligence and computers and that are basically challenging the brain and getting smarter than the brain does, this is not correct. No.
So there's no threat after all.
Well, it depends, of course. It could be the case that you are decreasing your cognitive abilities to a level of a computer, and then you get replaced by a computer. And I think this is way more dangerous in our times than computers becoming smarter than human beings. And there's another great quote by one of the German computer pioneers, Konrad Zuse, who said, "The danger of machines becoming like human beings is not as great as the danger of human beings becoming like machines." And we always treat ourselves as machines, as algorithms. We want to think perfectly, avoid mistakes, think inside inside the box and focused. But this is what machines can do as well. So try to unleash your creative capacity. Try to connect with others. Try to find not only correlations, but try to understand the world. This is what makes us human and unique, and not perfectionism and working flawlessly.
Yes, and the title of your book is Scatterbrain. So there is so much about the brain and our biology that not only contradicts the trend of digitization, but also uses our innate biology to be that creative person. And is there actually a functioning part of our brain that explains how we learn from our mistakes?
Well, there's not a specific area that is dedicated to analyzing mistakes or learning from mistakes. It's more an interplay between regions that are in the frontal part of your brain and more and regions that are deeper inside the brain, more in the hind part of the brain. And it's this interplay. One region is creating new thoughts, new possibilities, new options, and sometimes an option, may it be correct or not, slips through these filter mechanisms, and then these frontal areas basically evaluate and check whether this option or whether this pattern or whether this thought or whether this decision was good or bad, whether it was a mistake or not. And then it's playing back. It's like a feedback loop into the other brain region that is basically then correcting its processes so the mistake will not happen again. So it's always try and error. And so we constantly learn from our failures. And interestingly, people learn better or understand stuff better when they are encouraged to do mistakes, and being able to learn from mistakes is the best way to learn.
I'm wondering if there is a way for schools to actually implement that. Have you ever seen anything like that? Or
Oh yeah. There are nice projects, not only in schools, but also in companies. Always when people try to learn and understand stuff, usually it goes like this. You explain stuff to people, then people have to basically do some homework or do some exercises, and there's a test the week later. But interestingly, you can do it also the other way around. You can say, okay, here's a task. Try to find a solution for your own. And then you discuss what people did, how they try to come to the solution, and then you discuss it and you learn from the mistakes the people did. And there is some very nice studies showing, for instance, if you ask people, okay, listen, you are the manager of a basketball team. So it's the final game in the series, and four of your starting five already, but the fifth player is not pretty clear. And then you give two different options for players, player one, which was more consistent, player two, who had some very good games in the past, but also very bad ones. And then you let people decide who's the more consistent player. And they try to find out things about standard deviation, about variation, about statistics, by playing around with the numbers. Let people play. Let people try to find their own solutions and then discuss it and learn from the mistakes and failures to get better.
I like that you wrote, don't worry, it is not your brain's job to save as much information as possible. It's better that it forgets the right things at the right time, and also that the brain is not an organizational fanatic. And maybe you could share some about that and why that's been our biological development.
Yeah, this is also pretty nice because the brain... The brain is not designed for anything like thinking into perfectionism and trying to avoid mistakes. The purpose of our brain is that you can behave adaptively in a changing world. And so it's very important that we try things and we learn from these things, way more important than doing it perfectly. Interestingly, when you do mistakes and when the brain slips and has a flaw or blunders, there are a lot of brain regions active, but one is missing, the region controlling fear. We have no inherited fear of making mistakes. No kid is afraid of starting to speak because it could do a mistake. So we learn from our mistakes, and we should not treat people like perfect machines that are remembering everything that work perfectly all the time. But it's the mistake that makes us human. It's the mistake that distinguishes us from non-creative machines. Yeah.
Well, the fear issue, I'm sure it's been studied from a zillion different directions, right? And I'm sure many of us could appreciate hearing about conquering the fear of public speaking that you write about in your book.
Yeah. So what you can do about this is a very common fear, first to say. What you can do about this is what you call prognosis training. It's like a trick. Usually people are afraid of speaking in public because they are not used to it, and they are afraid of the stress they are faced with when they speak up in front of many people. So what you can do, you can practice and train this. You can go to your friends, you can go to some people and ask them, listen, I'm giving a talk right now, and you can basically rehearse the stress situation in a safe environment. And thereby people unlearn this stressful situation, and they learn how to deal with the stress situation, because way more difficult than speaking in front of others is to deal with the stress. And this is usually leading to a blackout or leading to mistakes, because people are afraid of this stressful situation. If you reframe this, if you tell people, listen, stress is not a bad thing, it's making you more concentrated, you can train this before, then you lose the fear of being stressed in front of others.
Yes. What is the significance of you writing about planning as a trap?
Yeah, this is a nice thing, because when you are very familiar with a topic, when you're very familiar with the process and you plan this process for the future, you do something we call planning fallacy, that you underestimate time and resources and money it needs to accomplish that project. The reason for this is that the brain constantly underestimates what happened in the past. When you do things very often, for instance, buying like presents for Christmas, and you have done that, I don't know, 20, 30 times, and then you forget retrospectively how long it took to buy all these presents. So for the future, the brain says, okay, it was not very new. Last year was like the year before, Okay, I can manage this, and I can imagine how long it takes. But this is usually wrong. And so people underestimate the time it takes to buy presents for Christmas. And this is always the case with big projects. Many of these projects run out of time, run out of money, run out of resources, because too many people compare this project with projects they had done before. So way better is to ask non-experts, ask someone who's not an expert in the field, and he or she is usually giving you a better estimation about the time it takes and the money you need. This is the reason why consulting works, right? You ask people who are not into that project, who are experts in other fields, but they are giving you a new perspective, a view from outside. And thereby, you're not trapping into this planning fallacy, and usually your estimations get more accurate.
Can you describe pattern thinking that you write about, and is there a way to develop that positively?
Yeah, unfortunately, as I said, the human brain is very lazy, and we try to do things in the most simple way as possible. So we think in stereotypes, we think in patterns all the time in order to keep it simple. So when you step into a new building, it only takes 1 or 2 seconds to understand how a new building or rooms in this building work, like how a kitchen works or like a new bathroom works. You don't have to think about this twice. Unfortunately, we do this all the time, and this is why we form prejudices, and this is why we form stereotypes. It makes it simple. Of course, you don't have to think a lot, but usually, or very often, you trap into that fallacy of thinking too fast, that you're not challenging your stereotypes and beliefs. To make it positive, or to turn it into a positive perspective, again, ask yourself, what if I am wrong? Ask people who are not sharing your opinion, because usually this really spices up your ideas. We are living in times when it's so easy to find opinions and solutions and perspectives that are similar to yours. This is basically the principle of the internet industry, right? Amazon, Facebook, Google, all these, Spotify, all these companies work by finding correlations and similarities. Important is that from time to time, challenge these perspectives, challenge your point of view, ask other people in order to develop new points of views, because otherwise you're caught in this stereotype fallacy.
Yes, certainly that is very true, and thank you for sharing that. Now, what do you have to say about the intersect between the brain and the mind? Obviously, we can cut open a head and say, okay, here's the brain, but...
Yeah, so what, right? Just your brain, but
yeah,
nothing but.
It's salts and water. What is this actually doing?
Yeah, this is really what is also... This is the great mystery about the brain, and this is really what's catching my attention too. Because when you look at the brain from outside, you just see a tissue. You just see cells. You don't see how this organ creates thoughts. Right? When you look at a heart from outside, or a gut, or a lung, you see how it works principally, but not with the brain. The hypothesis right now is that the brain, how these brain cells interact, not what they do, but how they do it, how they stimulate each other, this is what you experience as a thought or consciousness. So a thought is not located anywhere, and no matter how deeply you look into the brain, you will never find a thought. You will never find a memory. You will never find information or emotion, because it's how these brain cells interact in a very specific way. And this way, this how to interact, this is what could be considered as a thought, despite the fact that this is not really discovered right now. So there needs to be more research to be done, but we have some good hypotheses how the brain creates consciousness or thoughts.
When you talk about pulling up a memory at a certain time, or you're looking at a problem and solutions just kind of pop in from nowhere, that's the fascinating piece. And I'm wondering where you go down that rabbit hole. Do you feel like there's any kind of inner guidance system, or do you feel like it's not as mysterious maybe as it might be purported to be?
First, what you mean when you say you have a problem or you think about stuff. Usually this is what is happening in your consciousness. We know that from studies, this is basically part of your working memory is taking place. This is frontal parts of your brain focusing on stuff, like you listening to me right now. So the frontal parts of your brain are active. So you remember what I said at the beginning of this sentence. You're active listening. Usually what happens when you have a problem and you are not coming to a solution, what the brain constantly does, it is mind wandering. It is drifting away. It is daydreaming. Other regions are important for this cognitive process, and they are running subconsciously, and you cannot control this actively. This is what you know when you're driving a car. You know that you're driving a car for half an hour, you're daydreaming, your mind is somewhere else, and you don't remember what happened in the last 30 minutes. And this is important in order to get new ideas. We call it inspiration, that you basically step back from a problem, let your mind wander, and thereby attracting new points of views. Then these regions that are running subconsciously, they basically feed these thoughts into the working memory, into the frontal parts of the brain, and there they are evaluated, there they become conscious, and this is the moment when you say, ah, now I got it.
Considering the last quote in your book, Scatterbrain, whatever you do, whatever you think or research, nature is always right. Do you feel like the bulk of neurological research is supporting this?
My teacher told me that when I was at school. This basically means that you should be humble when you study nature, because every human being thinks that he or she knows how things work, and we have our hypotheses and we have our opinions. But in fact, it's nature is correct. Laws are in nature. We don't invent our natural laws. We find them, and we have to discover them. So we have to be kind of humble when we do research in nature. Many times we want our opinions to be true. We have our thinking style, we have our perspectives, we have our experiences, we want them to be true. And usually do it the other way around. Try to falsify yourself, try to challenge yourself, and then you find the interesting stuff nobody else does.
Beautifully said. Appreciate your time so much and for writing Scatterbrain.
Thanks a lot.
Henning Beck. His book is Scatterbrain. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on iTunes as Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.